Hello, everybody, and welcome to Fire Engineering Talk Radio and another installment of the Professional Volunteer Fire Department, the podcast that is dedicated to our great volunteer fire service and getting firefighters to embrace that message that developing and displaying and maintaining a professional image, a professional reputation, it's the duty and responsibility of all firefighters, paid or volunteer. And true professionalism is never defined by a paycheck. It's defined by our very real examples of service and competency and compassion and courtesy. Tom Merrill here, glad to have you listening in. It's Tuesday, December 14th, and I really thank you for being here this evening. And also thanks, of course, to Fire Engineering and Chief Bobby Halton and Clarion Events for supporting these podcasts, my Professional Volunteer Fire Department podcast, as well as all the other great podcasts that are out there covering so many great topics in the fire service. And I'm really honored, I'm humbled, and I really appreciate that you choose to listen into my show. And I just want you to know, as 2022 draws clear, that I'm going to remain committed to all of you to continue to focus on topics of relevance and importance and of concern to our volunteer fire service. And if anyone would like me to cover a particular topic, has an idea, would like to be a guest to talk about something, certainly reach out to me, and my contact information will be at the end of the show, as it always is. So feel free to reach out to me. And yes, 2022 is drawing close, and you know, Christmas is almost here. And I also want to take the opportunity to wish all of you a very Merry Christmas or a very wonderful holiday season, whatever it is you choose to celebrate. I just want you to know that I wish you all the best during the holiday season and enjoy a time spent with your loved ones, your family, your friends, your coworkers, your fellow firefighters down at the firehouse. This should be a great month, a joyful month, and we have so much to be thankful for. And heck, we survived another crazy year, right? And as I said, 2022 is coming. And let's hope we can put this COVID crap behind us. I know we're tired of talking about COVID. It's been talked about. It's certainly in the news again, making more news with the new variant, right? We want to put it behind us. We want to get back to normal. But I think it's important as professional first responders to recognize that not only is it still around, but we still have to remain vigilant. We still have to take the steps that are necessary to protect ourselves and our crews, and by extension, our family members and everyone that's near and dear to us. Because COVID's still a force to be reckoned with. And I don't want to be a downer, especially this, you know, joyous time of year. But I think it's important to have an understanding of the numbers, the COVID numbers, as they relate to us first responders. So I just wanted to take a moment to share with you and help us all understand this impact, this tragic impact that COVID's having, not just on the general population, but on our beloved fire service and first responder community. And I just have some numbers that are very sobering. And these numbers are through like mid-November. So they're almost a month old. So I'm sure they've even increased since then. But, you know, there's been 212 firefighter deaths so far due to COVID. 86 in 2020. And then I think we're at 126 so far this year. And again, that was mid-November. So unfortunately, those numbers might even be higher. But 212 firefighter deaths, 82 EMS personnel deaths. And our law enforcement brothers and sisters are not immune from this either. They've suffered right along with us to the tune of 635 COVID-related fatalities. I think it was 245 last year. They're at like 231 this year. So it's there. It's something to be thought about. And as you know, I'm a fire dispatcher. I work at the fire alarm office, and even my brothers and sisters at the alarm office and in the communication centers have been affected. There's been 18 dispatchers or communication center workers that have died due to COVID. So it's just something to be aware of. And remember, we're not out of the woods yet. So just please take the steps that are necessary to protect yourself and your crews and your family. And of course, we all hope things get better for 2022. And hopefully we get back to some sense of normalcy. We started making progress this year, but we're not out of the woods yet. And speaking of 2022, it's not too early to start making plans to attend the greatest fire conference in the world. Of course, I'm talking about FDIC in Indianapolis. I'm going to be back doing my four-hour pre-conference workshop, the Professional Volunteer Fire Department. I'm always so excited to do that. I'm always adding new material because there's always new material out there for me to add and talk about. So I'm always keeping it fresh and relevant. And I'm looking forward to being there and meeting so many great sisters and brothers like yourself. Hopefully you can make it there. It'll be April 25th to 30th in Indianapolis. And as of now, my class is scheduled for Tuesday, the 26th from 8 till noon. And I certainly hope I can see many of you there. It's the greatest conference in the world. And if you've been, you know how true that is. And I also just wanted to take 1 minute to make you aware of a great course being offered by the National Volunteer Fire Council for free. And you know, I always talk about the National Volunteer Fire Council. It's such a great organization. They have so many great resources. So I encourage all of you to become a member personally and also to sign your department up for membership in the National Volunteer Fire Council. There's just so many resources that they offer on, you know, recruitment and retention and mental health awareness and fitness and leadership. So go on over to nvfc.org and check out what they have to offer, including this new offering that I just came across. And hey, I thought, you know, this is a show about the volunteer fire service. I thought I would pass this on to you. It's a new course and it's directed at our families, our fire service families. And it's just in time for the holidays too, which I thought was kind of cool. You know, families certainly are what? Our biggest supporters, right? It's important that they understand what we do, what we go through, what experiences we are dealing with. And the new course is titled For Those Who Love a First Responder. And what it's doing, it's designed to educate spouses and friends and family of first responders on the impact the job has on the mental health of the responders and what our loved ones can do to support us. And it's being led by Allie Rothrock. And if you can remember, she's a great speaker. She's an educator. She was on my show about 2 years ago. Some of you may recall that. It was a very, very powerful show. We got a lot of feedback on that show. It had to do with her journey through the volunteer fire service. And it wasn't a great journey to start with. It was actually a heartbreaking, frustrating, and left many of us very angry at what she had to deal with. It was one of the most powerful shows I've probably ever done. But it was also inspiring because her resiliency was incredible, and she was able to use her bad experiences to help lead her to where she's at today and what she's involved with today, including being CEO and a lead instructor for On the Job and Off, which is an online platform that's dedicated to building more resilient first responders. And so she put this class together, and I encourage you, check it out. Maybe watch it with your loved ones. Maybe make it a drill night at the firehouse for everybody, family and firefighters and members. So head on over to nvfc.org and check out the new offering For Those Who Love a First Responder. I think it would be well worth it. I plan on doing that myself. Now, on to tonight's show. As you know, in the volunteer fire service, in the fire service in general, we respond to quite a variety of calls, don't we? EMS, motor vehicle accidents, rescues, and of course, those alarm calls, those fire alarm activations, as we call them in my area. We respond to so many of these pesky calls that oftentimes we take them for granted. I mean, we all have those senior homes or those group homes or those businesses that see a lot of alarm activations for many reasons, right? We have the burnt food. We have workers testing and failing to notify. We have the malfunction that we code a lot of them as. And the reasons are endless. But what can happen is complacency. Well, that can set in easily. Heck, I remember as a chief of department once going on a routine fire alarm call one night around the corner from my house at a group home and telling my wife I'll be home in 5 minutes because we went there, you know, a couple of times a month, only to arrive on location and see residents at the front door evacuating the home with smoke coming out over their head because there was a fire in the attic. It happens. And actually, that was one of several fires, as I look back on my career as chief, that came in as an alarm call that turned out to be a working fire. And even if we do respond to alarm calls and take them seriously, and there's no fire, it's so often that we hit the reset button without truly understanding why the alarm went off in the first place. Sometimes the panel's very intimidating. I think our guest says it looks like something out of science fiction, but they're intimidating and we really don't know or understand what we're looking at. So we just get used to hitting reset. So that's what we're going to spend some time on tonight. We're going to spend some time talking about fire alarm systems so we can understand a little bit more about them and maybe what we should be doing as we respond to these types of calls. And to join me in this discussion, I am so honored to have Chief Steve Heckman. He is a deputy chief in the Trenton, Maine Volunteer Fire Department. He's a facility supervisor for the Jackson Laboratory in Bar Harbor, Maine, where among other duties, he's responsible for fire protection systems. He's also an adjunct instructor for Eastern Maine Community College's Fire Science Program, and he serves as a fire instructor for the Maine Fire Service Institute and for the local Hancock County Fire Academy. And oh, by the way, he's also written for fire engineering, and he's a fellow FDIC instructor. And that's where I got to know the chief, because back in August, I sat in his class, A Simplified Approach to Understanding Fire Alarm Systems, which is a fantastic class. If you're going to FDIC, make sure you stop in and sit in on that class. This is a great class. He's presented it several times. He's going to be back next year, so I encourage you to take it in. So, Chief Heckman, thank you for being here with us today, and welcome to the show.
Thank you, Chief. I really appreciate the opportunity. I'm very honored and humbled to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you, and I noticed on your business card, I knew I was going to like everything you did and what you stand for, because when I got your business card at FDIC after sitting in on your class and I walked away and I look at it and it says Trenton Volunteer Fire Department professional volunteer since 1968. So you embrace the message of professionalism, don't you?
Yeah. And unfortunately that card has a typo. It's supposed to be 1958, but I didn't want to go back to the printers.
I'll be looking for that one next year after I see it. Sounds like a plan. Card from you. So good to have you here. And before we get into alarm systems, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about your fire service journey? I always like to have our guests do a little bio on themselves and talk a little bit about what got you into fire service. Are you first generation, second generation? How'd you end up in the Trenton, Maine Volunteer Fire Department?
Well, it's kind of an interesting story. When I, a lot of my family was part of the volunteer fire service, but nobody talked about it. When folks moved away, I had grandparents that moved to Florida, and then come to find out when he passed away, they put that part of his obituary. It was like, nobody ever told us. I had a stepfather that was a member of the fire service, and myself, I more migrated to the industrial commercial side of fire protection and didn't have a lot to really do with the fire service. But you get to a point in your life, you realize I need to give back. And the best place to give back with my background in fire protection systems was the volunteer fire service. I lived in Trenton, and I told my wife, I said, I think I'm going to join the volunteer fire department. And they accepted me, and the rest is history. But for the facility that I work with, we were hazmat technicians. They used to have a fire brigade. They disbanded it. And so we had interactions with the local fire department. But you realize, like I said, you just have to give back, and it's been an honor, and it's been a very rewarding career doing just that.
Yeah, we do make a career being volunteer firefighters, don't we? I say that all the time. We absolutely do. We have two careers, maybe the one that puts food on our table, but if you're doing the job, especially as a chief officer or an officer in your hometown volunteer department, man, it's a second career. It really is.
Yes, it is.
And you and I love fire service history. I gather that about you from reading your articles and talking to you. So I thought it would be fun, also practical, but, dive in a little bit of the history of alarm systems. Matter of fact, I got a prized possession this summer. I always wanted a fire alarm box, and I finally got a Gamewell fire alarm street corner box that works. Happened to pull a few strings and got it. I just had to take it down. It's usually on a mantle in our family room, but due to the Christmas decorations, my wife yanked it. It had to go for Santa on the mantle. So I had to put it away for Christmas, but I'm so excited to have my Gamewell Street box in mint condition. But, you know, another thing I just thought of too is talk about history. I never knew about the Gamewell fist. And for my listeners, what I'm talking about, on a lot of communication center logos and patches, there's a fist with lightning bolts coming out of it, including my own alarm office patch where I work at the fire alarm office. I never knew what that meant. Well, when I got this box, this fire alarm box, I started reading about the history of Gamewell, and I didn't realize it's called the Gamewell fist, I believe. And that's the logo that a lot of communication center use. It's the Gamewell logo. Anyway, that was a little segue. I thought we could get a little bit into the history. I think one thing you pointed out, we're talking 170 years now since the municipal fire alarm system. And I love what you said in some notes you provided to me about how the alarm system predates the light bulb. I thought that was great.
Yeah, it is. It's really interesting. And you're not alone. I have one that I proudly display on my library bookshelf. And I remember when I was finding a place for it, my wife's like, are you going to keep that in the house? Can you move that somewhere else? And I was like, no, that's my centerpiece. That's, because I have a sector box that is right around the turn of the century. And I have a full size box as well. And yeah, it's really interesting when you look at the history of the fire alarm telegraph, because it wasn't really called the Gamewell system until after the Civil War, when John Gamewell purchased all the patent rights. He had the patent rights to the southern states, but then with the Civil War, they yanked them. And so it's kind of interesting to listen to some of that history. But when he bought them, he got them back, and he really started to ramp up the making of the fire alarm boxes. It really is, that was the industry got started. And it is amazing. It and I talk about it in my class for my college students. It predates the light bulb. Remember in the early 1800s or the mid 1800s, electricity was still in its infancy. And so, we open that box up and you see that tapper in there. That was used. It really revolutionized how the fire departments would communicate, because they were actually able to request second alarms. They were able to request additional apparatus. They were able to cancel alarms remotely from those street boxes. And there's some really interesting points about that, where, we didn't have two-way radios. And so you saw this whole, this whole industry in the fire service, how it changed. We were able to, make those, and we call them box assignments or alarm assignments, and, tapping the box because we would strike a second alarm or third alarm or more. And it's really interesting. You look at it, and they're still there, and they're still available, because they're still installed in some areas or replaced. Unfortunately, we see it being retired for the most part. But because it was such a sound system and it had such major relevance in this country and across the world, it really would set the stage for all fire alarm systems that would come after it.
So this system, the alarm systems of today, can trace their roots to these original alarm boxes that were, what were they, just on street corners? Was that the beginning of they weren't worried about monitoring buildings at that point, correct? It was a means for communicating, A, there's a fire, and then B, the fire companies could use it to communicate for more equipment and things like that. Is that how it all started? They just were on the street corners?
Yeah, I mean, that's was the first installed in Boston. And the story, as I understand it, the historical perspective is the very the day that it was installed, I think it was the very next night, they had an alarm struck. It worked, and it really kind of proved the concept. And, the rest of history. There was never the ability to kind of bring that fire alarm capability to every street corner until William Channing and Moses Farmer put that first system together. And so building alarm systems, you rent out to the street box. In fact, you can sometimes find the labels that will say, you know, sound alarm nearest street boxes on the corner of, you know, Main mm-hmm. and Maple, you know, Avenue or something like that. And some of the old, it was part of your public education, you would teach school children in the classroom in the, you know, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, know where your nearest street box is. And so it's kind of like, yeah, that's what we used to do. And yeah. That was kind of a common educational message.
So what era are we talking here where they first came out? Was it pre-Civil War or was it post-Civil War?
It was 1851.
Okay.
And it's kind of an interesting story because William Channing, he would approach the Boston City Council and they turned him down a couple times. And then he finally convinced, he was apparently a very good speaker, had a good convincing argument. What's kind of interesting, he was a doctor. And he didn't have a clue about electricity. So he would team up with Moses Farmer to build that first box. And the success went from there. You know, William Channing, he was a great spokesman. He went to the Smithsonian. He really was a great marketer. But he was enamored with the telegraph, you know, Moore's telegraph and that whole, this new way of communicating. Envisioned this idea for the fire alarm on every street corner, got it, developed, put it into mm-hmm. practice. And then of course the Civil War hit. And so a lot of things kind of slowed because that was not the main concern for the country. But afterwards, and that's where you see that John Gainwell had met with Channing at the Smithsonian when he was doing a speech. He bought the patent rights for the Southern states, and then they took those patent rights away from him during the Civil War. And it was one of his friends that actually bought them back. And then he eventually would buy the entire patent rights. And it was kind of interesting. William Channing, he would go on to go in another direction for communications. He started to follow Alexander Graham Bell, you know, for the telephone. And so, he gave up the rights to the fire alarm telegraph. Gainwell bought it, really started to mechanize it with the clockwork and really put it to where it is today. It's still in service, like in a lot of New England states, some other areas, but really would start that whole progression of fire alarm signaling. And the successes of that system would be directly incorporated into building fire alarms, and the failures would be engineered out. And that was probably one of the greatest achievements of Gainwell, was the fact that let's engineer the failures out to make this system as the most reliable in the world. And the fire alarm and the National Board of Fire Underwriters, they would see the value of it. And they would actually start to, you know, as building fire alarms started to come along with the thermostatic, the electrothermostatic, the auxiliary systems, yes, you can put it in, but you have to follow some of these rules and guides that have been determined to be successful from the municipal system.
Yeah.
You start looking at some of the history and some of the requirements and you're like, well, that's over here. Well, that predates this. And so, like I talk about in my FDIC program, the idea that Gainwell would produce this ability for the telegraph system to watch itself. And by doing so, if a wire came unhooked or, they had an intentional or an unintentional break of any of its circuits, it would provide that one blow of all the gongs and the bells in the city, calling that attention to its temporarily disabled condition. And that concept, that proof of concept that worked for reliability has continued through. It wasn't called the trouble signal at the time, but it would eventually be known as the trouble signal.
Wow.
And it would be part of every fire alarm system in existence after that to really monitor its own integrity. And it really started this whole ball rolling. And we talk about and I talk about in my FDIC presentation and in my college courses, that one blow of the alarm bells. And we still see that with our home smoke alarms. You know, if the battery becomes weak or we have another problem with the device, we get a one chirp or a single chirp. And we can trace that right back to this whole concept of monitoring the power within the system to make sure that it's functioning properly.
Yeah, you can see how everything's tied together and related. And, you know, you talk about the Gainwell box. And I was just down in downtown Buffalo over the weekend. We were down doing some activities in downtown Buffalo. And they're still, they've taken a lot of the boxes out, but there's still enough of them. As we were walking around, I saw many street corners with the Gainwell box. And I was trying to point it out to my wife and daughters. They could care less, but I was all excited when I saw that. So did it slowly start getting into the buildings? Like, I know it started at the intersections and people needed to be aware of where the alarm system, the closest alarm box was if they saw a fire. When did they start monitoring buildings, or when, how did that idea come about that, hey, if we can telegraph fires from intersections, can we maybe put it in the building? How did that evolve?
Well, the there was a lot of different folks out there and started to, I think with the advent of the municipal system, there was, it was obviously, you know, it's like any invention will breed additional inventions and or changes or modifications. And so we would see the thermal electric system, the early heat detection systems start to be installed in the mills, start to be installed in some of the industry of the day, because the value of buildings, the value of the commodities within the side, the buildings were actually worth more now than the buildings themselves. So it really came down to commodity protection. But we would see that as the high rises started to be more prevalent in the cities, and you would start seeing like the Woolworth building, or you would start seeing some of these buildings built in the early 1900s with, you know, 70, 80, 90 stories to make your way from the upper stories down the stairwell or down the elevator, through the lobby, out the door, you know, to the street corner, you would waste valuable time. And so we saw the advent of the auxiliary system. Now, that was interesting because the auxiliary system was basically the old ring style pool boxes that would be placed on every floor of the building or every other floor. They were required to be at least 200 feet up. Well, the maximum distance was 200 feet to actually travel to one of these auxiliary pool boxes. It's interesting. The life safety code still refers to the maximum distance can be traveled is 200 feet to a manual pool station. It's like, wow, that's never really changed. But that was actually part of the auxiliary system in the early 1900s. And then there was this other company that said, hey, Gainwell, we actually produce thermal electric wire. Heat sensing wire, where if it gets hot, it melts together and causes the alarm. And so they got a permission from Gainwell to actually wire the auxiliary boxes all the way through the building out to the alarm box. And so if there was a fire in the building when the building wasn't occupied, well, the heat detection wire would fuse together, causing the alarm at the street box. And so here comes this whole automatic alarm systems, automatic alarming that started to be take place. And then we would start seeing the requirements for these thermoelectric systems, monitoring for their integrity, proper testing, maintenance, installation. One of the problems with the thermoelectric wire back in the day is, of course, they would run it through the different wall cavities. Rodents were a problem in the late 1800s, early 1900s. So I don't know what was actually on the old wire, but they would sometimes gnaw at it and then call the alarms. And so we have this automatic alarming ability, and we start seeing the inherent flaws that really started to come to life. The street boxes had their own flaws. Well, you know, kids maybe activating an alarm, or there's a, and it's in a new article that's going to be published in 2022 for Fire Engineering, where Fire and Water Engineering with Chief Brody was a guest speaker at the Massachusetts State Fire Convention. And he would talk about all the, he actually in his presentation, the comical musings of people who would storm the box, you know, and would, you know, crank the box handle multiple times, and it would look like buckshot at the central station because nobody could make heads or tails of it, or would turn the knob backwards. So, you know, box, you know, 37 would come in as box 73, you know, that would send people. So they had, you know, we have these, this great invention of the fire alarm system, but there's always, you know, there's the human element, and then you have the environmental element that the best laid intentions, you know.
So, right. You know, some notes I had from your class, when did, so I see how this all evolved. Now you get the monitoring. What about sprinklers? Did they come in into this too? When did they start monitoring sprinklers? How did that come about?
Well, sprinklers would get their start soon after the advent of the building fire alarm systems, you know, the thermostatic systems, because mm-hmm. Obviously sprinklers are thermally activated devices. We can trace that back to the Parmalee system, where he didn't like the rates he was getting for his piano shop. So he created the first automatic sprinkler that, you know, the cap fell off, and this basically salt and pepper type shaker would spray water. And so this whole industry would also start getting the ball rolling. The invention started, and you started to see the Grinnell system. They really kind of latched onto it, started making sprinklers. And again, you know, if anybody ever sees some of the advertisements of the 19th century, there was not a lot of regulations when it came to advertisements. And so they would advertise the sprinkler, you know, as, you know, the absolute best thing in the world. And it really was, but, you know, it had its problems. You know, they didn't have the soldering down right. But eventually they would start working those problems out. And somewhere towards the, I'm going to say the late 1800s, somewhere around the 1870s, 1880s, the true sprinkler that kind of takes shape, the ones that we see today, they look familiar. I actually have one in my mantle, one from the early 1900s. You know, that's the basic shape. It take, you know, and it was working. And so the obviously, because as I previously mentioned, the value of the commodities inside these buildings were worth more than the building itself, the insurance industry really said, hey, you know what, this has some really good merit. The automatic sprinkler, where, you know, the original sprinkler or the perforated pipe sprinkler system, where you'd open the valve and it would just flood the entire building, all the contents were usually ruined, which I believe sometimes is where that whole concept, when one goes off, they all go off, kind of got its start, because we had perforated pipe and then you had open sprinklers. And then we came with this this capped sprinkler, or this ability to only discharge water over the area of the fire. And so, you know, the insurance companies, which, you know, hey, they want to lessen claims and they want to protect their assets. They really saw the value of the automatic sprinkler. And so they would say, hey, you know what? They would start giving rate reductions if you would install these devices in these buildings. But that was really for the precursor for the importance of sprinkler systems.
And then obviously the sprinkler systems got tied into the alarm systems at some point, where if it goes off, it would trigger a signal, correct? So it's continuing exactly with this evolution.
Of this evolution of automatic signaling. So,
and then, you know, I have written in my notes from your class, and maybe you can shed some light on it. There was a manual system where there was a lot to check with these sprinkler systems. And it was a process of making sure things were in working order. There were supposed to be inspections and there were supposed to be inspection sheets, and that may or may not have happened. Did that somehow lead to the development of the supervisor? I get confused between supervisory trouble, all of that. And I was wondering, is that what led to the manual system wasn't working? So they came up with a automatic system.
Absolutely. It's kind of interesting to look at some of the early handbooks of fire protection. We call it the fire protection handbook today. But you can kind of see, I refer to one of them that was the 1901 fire protection or handbook of fire protection. And you can almost read between the lines. And when Everett Crosby wrote, it's like, all we're trying to do is to keep the gate valves open. Because the number one reason sprinkler systems fail, closed valves or partially closed valves. And that was the problem back in the late 1800s into the early 1900s. The fire and underwriters were like, man, we're still getting losses. And rightly so, they would investigate. And so what did they find? Well, the closed valve was the number one reason these systems were failing. And so they would actually incorporate what they called a supervision by the insurance interest. That whole process was to take the insurance inspector and make them a little bit more responsible for ensuring that the fire protection equipment was properly maintained and in operational readiness. It was an operational order. And so, it's kind of the musings were, originally the inspector, all they had to do was make sure that the pump was connected to the standpipe and the hand grenades were on the wall. But now they had to start, evaluating piping, evaluating sprinklers, evaluating the pressure tanks, evaluating cisterns, evaluating all this stuff to ensure that the fire protection equipment, primarily the water-based fire protection equipment, because that was what really was going to protect the assets of the insurance underwriters, that was ready to go. And, it's interesting, like I said, you hear that kind of inflections in his voice is just, we're just trying to keep the gate valves open. So they called it the supervision by the insurance interest, and then they would create this inspection sheets for the owners that they would take on their own responsibility to ensure that their fire protection equipment was working properly. And they called it supervision by the owners. And it was in the form of manual blank inspection sheets. The problem was, is that as mentioned in the handbook, the owners of these buildings were like, yeah, to the insurance inspector. But once the insurance inspector left, it was like, fill these out. I got other things to do. Mimic that big boss or the foreman of the mill, fill these things out, put them on my desk in the morning, And so that's what would happen. And so it was kind of interesting in the dialogue is like these forms were more or less intelligently filled out is what the book says. And I was like, oh, you know what? You can tell that that's some of the precursors for it. So what they found is that even though they put this inspection system into place with these inspection sheets, sprinkler buildings were still burning, And it was like their best laid intentions, they're still burning. And so they would check into it, why this was, and what'd they find? Well, the closed valve.
Closed valves.
Closed valve. And so this is where we really start seeing this evolution of the supervisory service. And this is where the insurance companies looked at the Gainwell system and this whole concept of it watching itself and said, can we use this to monitor our sprinkler equipment? Not the flow alarms. The flow alarms, they work, but it's the ones that the things that don't get, the gate valve gets closed. Can we use this system that watches itself that gives an indication if a broken wire is found? And whatever, you know, what's a switch do? Switch acts like a broken wire. It's just manually operated. So a switch opens, acts just like a broken wire, and the alarm system will let us know that there's a problem. And so this is where this whole concept of supervisory service comes into play. And it was called supervisory service, but they would use this trouble indicator, this trouble capability of the system watching itself to make that happen. And you know, this was one of those things that I had written when I was at FDIC in 2019. And I was sitting in that 5:30, I think 5:30 or 7:30, where you have Chief Halton, several other members of the fire service. And it was Bill Gustin had said, you know, we just get firefighters to understand the difference between the trouble and the supervisory alarm or signals. And I'm thinking to myself, well, I know what that is. And I know that that's a problem. And that was kind of a precursor for me to write one of my first articles, and which really kind of goes through this whole process of the evolution of the trouble and the supervisory signal. And then what's nice about fire engineering, it's in the supplement, the July 2020 supplement. And fire engineering allows the supplements to be downloaded free of charge. So it's in there and really kind of gives you that history of how the underwriters really would push this this whole thing about how to use the trouble to create a supervisory service, but they didn't call it trouble. They called it supervisory, but they used the trouble. So,
so for our listeners, I was going to talk about this maybe down the road a little bit, but we might, this might be a good time. What is the difference? And as educated professional firefighters, we should know when somebody says we're getting a trouble signal or somebody says we're getting a supervisory signal, how are they related, not related? Is there a way to understand what the two mean?
Yeah, the trouble, basically, ever since 1993, was kind of relegated back to its originally intended purpose for overall system monitoring, you know, in the integrity of the alarm system itself. And I'll give you an example, just like our home smoke alarms, because our home smoke alarms are little miniature fire alarm systems, just in this little bitty package. You know, it has a detector, it has a sounder, it has a power supply, and it has a control board, you know. And so once we power it up, it starts to consume power. And through that consumption of power, it monitors its integrity. And that's where we get that trouble chirp or we get a trouble with the system. And that is what the trouble ultimately is to do, is to let you know that there's a problem with the system. Now, systems have expanded, so troubles could be communication, you know, because we don't think about it very often, but we all have wire, you know, cellular telephones. Well, we talk on our cellular telephones and our voice is transmitted into a wireless signal through, you know, radio frequencies. It's picked up by a transmitter and then it's put back into, you know, electrons and it moves. And so, you know, it's still electron flow, you know, so it's that electromotive force within the system is somehow being impaired. That is really what the trouble is. Supervisory is specific equipment monitoring, like a sprinkler system, you know, is the gate valve, which is a piece of equipment. The supervisory signal is telling us that piece of equipment is or possibly is impaired. You know, so we think about the closed valve, we get a supervisory signal. The fire pump is running. That is not nor necessarily an impairment, but something is going wrong with the system or something's happening that's alerting the supervisor of the facility, because really supervisory comes down to that whole idea, supervision by the owner, their interest to say, hey, there's something going on in my facility and I'm being alerted to it by the fire alarm system.
Gotcha. And another, through the whole evolution, I fast forwarded in my handwritten notes. I don't know if there's a big gap, but it was like in the 1980s, mid 80s, we got to what, the addressable systems of today. What's that mean, an addressable system?
Well, in around 1985, the first addressable system started to, appear. Addressable systems give us the ability to not just have a static switch. Okay, a heat detector is a static switch. A smoke detector is a static switch. It's that change of state causes the alarm, whereas the analog addressable, now we're actually communicating with a specific device that we give an address. Device number 10 is located in the cafeteria. Device number 12 is located in the janitor's closet. Device number 15 is located in the lobby. You know, so we can actually place those addresses and they communicate back to the fire alarm panel. The fire alarm panel says, hey, number 10, what's your status? And 10 will kind of communicate back and say, all clear, through an analog signal, that kind of simplifying it, but it does. It goes through, 11, what's your status? 15, what's your status? 25, what's your status? And it's monitoring that. So what we see is that we're actually being able to monitor the environment that device is located and provide additional meaning by giving it that address, that device 10, and I can correlate that either through a printed graphic or, a computer system that says, oh, device 10 is located here. Now
it makes our job a lot easier as firefighters responding to that alarm call. Now you have a basic idea of where the activation is in that big building.
Right. And that whole concept has evolved. Some fire alarm companies will address the detector itself. Other fire alarm companies will address the base. There's pros and cons to all of it. If the base is addressed, that rarely moves, but there's always the human element. If I put number 10 in where 15 is supposed to go and 15 where 10, because I either transposed my numbers or I was in a hurry. So the system is only as good as the people maintaining it.
Right. And while we're on this history talk, another thing I thought was really cool, and as professional firefighters, I think we should understand this. Maybe it's not the municipal alarm system, but the home smoke detector. I found it fascinating how you pointed out, and I'm a big fire service history buff, and the Lady of Angels fire in Chicago actually helped lead to the mainstream smoke detector of today, did it not? As a matter of fact, I think we're coming up on the anniversary of that fire. December is a tragic month. I think the anniversary of that fire is coming up, because I'm going to talk about it later on. But continuing with the discussion on alarm systems, again, it's not a municipal system, but our home smoke detector has an interesting history. And I think it was that Lady of Angels that led to the push to develop the, it took some time because it wasn't until the 70s, right, where it really became mainstream, but didn't that lead to it?
Absolutely. The smoke detector itself has a pretty interesting history. And I cover this in my FDIC presentation and my classes, but smoke detection has always had one inherent flaw, and it was susceptible to the unwanted alarm because it activates when it senses particulates. And you think about all the particulates, this whole planet's made up of particles, large and small, and our homes, everybody says cleaned out the vacuum cleaner, and it's like, wow, this nasty dust that we've collected, the powders, the industrial processes, vapors, all these are particulates. And so smoke detection had a very interesting history. It was developed in the late 30s. And I have I love fire history myself. And when I find a book that's related to fire history, I usually buy it, no matter what. But you see that smoke detection, some of its earliest uses was in the 1940s. And where would we see it installed? We saw it installed in vaults, fur storage vaults, safe deposit vaults, relay switching vaults. And when you think about vaults, you start realizing that, wait a second, ingress, egress, as well as the environment. because what I'm protecting in these vaults was valuable. And so we'd use smoke detection in these areas, and they recommended that they would placard and post signage warning that smoke detection is in use, because just somebody smoking a cigarette could activate the system and cause the, a lot of times because smoke detection works so well, we'd use it to protect high value commodities. Now, life is obviously the most highest value commodity, but think about death of a salesman. I'm going to try to sell a device that's prone, has these unwanted characteristics that everybody knew about. I put a smoke detector in, it's going to activate because somebody's cooking or somebody's beating a rug or something like that, because they were susceptible to unwanted alarms. And so go back to the vaults, we would control the heating, the ventilation, the refrigeration, the humidities, and the ingress and egress out of these vaults. And so it wasn't until the Our Lady of Angels fire that the Los Angeles Fire Department, along with several other fire departments, really started to step up their inspection program and would start testing conventional fire equipment. We think about the Our Lady of Angels fire was in 1958, December of 1958. And it was a tragic for this country. And, you know, the fire service, our business is to protect lives and property. And I admirable for the Los Angeles Fire Department to actually do what they did. And in stepping up their inspection process, they learned that there was a school that was actually slated for demolition. And I always have the book handy, because it's and I know you can't see the folks in the podcast can't see it, but it's a great read. It was not only for fire detection, but it really would sound the alarm per se, is that heat detection was not a viable solution. And so what's interesting in that whole that book, and I urge fire departments, if it's in their library, hold on to it, take advantage of it, to read it, because not only did they learn the value of the arrangement of fire protection devices and how heat operated devices didn't give enough time to get the students out of the building, but they also would discover other situations where things were rated as being fire retardant and they weren't. One of the stories it talks about being that the firefighters, you think about it, they were in the building doing the monitoring for visibility and determining when where the environment was no longer tenable. And, you know, they were there. There was no SCBA use. They were in that fire environment to basically make this better for school kids. Yeah. And so they would talk about some of the things when they were driven out of the building, because these things that were listed for fire use or fire safe equipment like acoustical ceiling tiles, they were driven out of the building. But one of the things that they learned in that was that no matter how they would place conventional fire equipment, fusible link sprinklers, fusible links that were on springs to open smoke vents, fusible links for doors, thermostatic devices, line type heat detection, spot type heat detection, they couldn't get the conditions. They couldn't make it so that people could have enough time to get out before conditions became untenable. And so they don't really say in the book whether it was through exasperation or desperation, but somebody decided, hey, let's try smoke detectors. And what they learned was that detectable quantities of smoke would precede measurable quantities of heat. And the kudos to the Los Angeles Fire Department, they were like, hey, whoa, we're in uncharted waters. Smoke detection is a niche market. But they begged that question, could smoke detection provide better life safety than heat detection? And so they recognized that they were in uncharted waters, that they needed to, more testing needed to be done. And sure enough, they found out 2 years later that they had not just one, but two schools that were subject to be demolished, and they called it Operation School Burning 2. And so I've always found it kind of interesting because, you know, we're firefighters, you get a little cynical. But when I look at the amount of folks in the fire alarm industry, the fire protection industry that signed on to help the Los Angeles Fire Department do these tests in 1959, compared to the number of fire protection industries that signed on to help in 1961, there's a big difference. And you think to myself, well, why is that? Well, they got the attention of a lot of folks out there. And so sure enough, in those 1961 tests, they realized, they confirmed. And, you know, if you read Operation School Burning 2, it's not as enjoyable read as Operation School Burning, because there's charts and graphs and scientific data and all of these different things. It's like, wow, it was really, really structured. But again, it was our fire service that did these tests and made sure these tests were done. And they determined that smoke detection could provide better life safety over heat detection.
And eventually, so, that leads to our home smoke detectors of
today. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, fascinating too, that one of the stats I took from your class is once home smoke detection became prevalent in the 70s, home fire deaths dropped 50%. 50%. Yes. Yep. And you think today it's something we take for granted. A lot of people died and suffered horrible injuries to lead to something we take for granted today.
Yeah, and it really is important to, you know, and just realize how the fire service was really the leaders in making this happen.
Yeah, for sure. And if anyone's looking for that book, the book that Chief's talking about, Operation School Burning, you can check. There's a lot of sites that have old books on them. The one that I use a lot is abe.com, abe.com, and you can get out-of-print books pretty inexpensive on that site. I don't know if they'll have Operation School Burning, but again, there's other sites out there. Maybe you could find it, but probably a must-have book for the fire bookshelf. And, you know, another thing I thought was interesting listening to you talk at FDIC was you noted that in the old days, there were a lot of people taking care of the systems. There was a lot of support, a lot of resources thrown. You've talked about all the resources going into maintaining these systems. Matter of fact, I think back to photos of the old fire alarm offices where 20 or 30 people were on duty, it seemed like, and all these wheels and things. And it's just crazy systems that had to be maintained. But today the firefighters have taken more of a back seat when it comes to these alarm systems. You know, installation companies are taking over and there's a lot of new technology. It's hard to stay current with the technology. A lot of designers and some of the installers lack due diligence. I can say working at the alarm office, when you ask questions to some of these people, they really can't answer them. And then firefighters get very little in terms of education when it comes to the alarm systems. If you're lucky, in my opinion, you might have a chief who understands these systems and maybe takes the time to mentor and teach the next generation, because that's often how we do learn, right? But there's very little in our Firefighter One book. There's very little in my experience in terms of mentoring. New firefighters watch officers go in, hit the reset button and leave, never really explain the process. There's just not a lot out there to educate us on these systems. And that's why I think it's important, Chief, that we take the time to talk about, you know, not just the history, but the system itself and how they came to be and, you know, the difference between supervisory and trouble. So I really appreciate, you know, what you're offering us. It's so important to have a basic understanding, because I think most companies go on a lot more alarm calls than they do actual fire calls.
Yeah, I think the statistics show, I think it was back in 2016 or maybe a little earlier, the average fire alarm response is like 2.2 million every year, give or take. And then we really find that basically like 1 in 12 actually involves a fire. You know, the problem is this is all we have. You know, these devices, this is all we have to warn us of a fire. And their use is paramount. And so, you know, one of the adages of us in the fire service is always expect fire. And kind of go back to your original story about the going around the corner, I'll be back in 5 minutes. Heat detection. We had a fire. We actually had an alarm call several years ago, and it was during a major rainstorm. And my own experience known that, building envelope leaks, water getting into devices can cause unwanted alarms. And, I'm thinking to myself, I bet you this got water into the building. But, fortunately we didn't, I didn't allow that to mitigate or change my response. And when we got there, sure enough, there was a fire. And then the folks haste to put the fire out. They knock over a gas can and the fire spreads. And it's just this whole comedy of errors. Fortunately, when we got there, the fire was out, everything was okay, but the system did exactly what it was. Yeah. And even though these ancillary events can actually cause an alarm, we have to always expect fire. And Absolutely. We can never let it to lessen our response.
And that leads into my next question. For the alarm call comes in as an alarm, what's a good process to follow for these alarm calls? I think in the class you outlined four different scenarios for fire department personnel to be prepared for. Obviously, always think fire, be prepared for fire. Maybe we could talk a little bit for the listeners, and especially newer firefighters that maybe don't know when that alarm goes off and they show up at that building. What are some things they should be thinking, and what are some of the steps they should be taking to properly investigate the alarm and then put it back in service? And we'll talk about that in a minute, if your jurisdiction lets you do that.
Right. And the thing is when we show up at these businesses, it's interesting. The business owners, the community we represent, they are expecting us, because we're firefighters, it's in our name. And they expect us to kind of know everything there is about fire, whether it's a fire protection system, the smoke alarms. I'll give an example. I can have a fire protection engineer in a suit and tie, and I could have Joe firefighter in their t-shirt that says, volunteer firefighter or fire department. And the public will go to the firefighter.
Sure.
To get information on how to protect their business, their homes, their families, and what's important to them. They will not go to this other individual, even though they are so much more versed in maybe that particular area of expertise. And so when we show up, these people are looking to us to have answers. And so our customer service, we want to support our communities. We have to, one, we're always going to go there expecting fire. Do we drop a line? I'm kind of an advocate for really thinking about drop that line and be ready, because you don't know what you're going to be dealing with. But other fire departments will take more of the wait and see approach. But really expect fire. And then if there isn't a fire, it really comes down to investigating. And doing a proper investigation. What caused this alarm to activate? There are predetermined things that we need to be aware of when we realize it's not a real fire situation. Recognize that the byproducts of combustion can be replicated by non-fire events. Suspended particles. What is a smoke detector? But it's a suspended particle detector. But nobody wants to market it as a suspended particle detector, because that's not sexy. That's not glamorous. That doesn't kind of drive home the importance of this critical life safety device. Gas, carbon monoxide, what caused it? We had a response to our SPCA, the animal shelter. And, no one told them, kudos to them. They had smoke detection, they have carbon monoxide, because they're trying to protect the animals. But nobody told them that particular carbon monoxide detection or alarm is also susceptible to ammonia. Can give them a false positive. And so when we went there, we got toned out to a carbon monoxide alarm. We did our due diligence. We got the meters out and we started testing, Our meters didn't show anything, but you could smell the ammonia in the air because they were using ammonia cleaners. And come to find out, we looked it up. Sure enough, that particular sensing element in that particular carbon monoxide device can give false positives about if they're using ammonia-based cleaners. And so here's an educational aspect. You know, hey, you're using ammonia-based cleaners. And it was just a matter of, oh, we'll just change our cleaning strategy. We'll go to a different basis when we clean. And guess what? We haven't been back for another carbon monoxide alarm. And so these are things that we can look at. We went to another a store, and you know, we talk about what causes suspended particles. Well, a lot of times it's ambient conditions. We went into the basement. The basement is heated, it's conditioned, but not, you didn't have any dehumidification, but we couldn't find the reason why the detectors were activating until we shut the lights off. Mm-hmm. And you shut the lights off, and every single one of us firefighters, we have those nice bright headlights on our helmets. You turn that light on, and there you could see it, that light gray mist, basically because the environmental conditions were, the humidity level was way up in the basement. The temperatures were cool, so you didn't really feel it. But, you know, one of the things often overlooked is relative humidity and how it plays a part in unwanted activations. And it's not one of those things we check in our NIFRS box because we don't have humidity meters on our trucks. But, you know, you can sometimes see that. And I often tell firefighters, shut the lights off. Let's shine a bright flashlight across the ceiling. And it's amazing sometimes what you can see. And a suspended particle detector or a smoke detector that doesn't know the difference between light gray smoke and light gray water vapor. And yeah, it's going to activate.
So easy to just put that as a malfunction. That's a malfunction.
It's a malfunction, but really the system is doing exactly what it's supposed to do. So recognizing some of those environmental conditions and then some of the other things that we've actually run into was smoke alarm activations. And we'll use our thermal imaging camera when we go into a house. And sure enough, you'll see that temperature difference around the smoke alarm. And these folks had a water leak. They had a roof leak. And so we were able to tell them, hey, we'll sure enough pull it down. The thing's just full of water. You know, well, the water caused the malfunction. But hey, you have another problem in your house. You have a water leak. Your roof is leaking. And so these are things that, in that particular case, it's it's kind of funny. They were more concerned how we got into their house than the fact that we told them they had a roof leak, but that's another story altogether. But then another, in other words, same thing, water leaks within the envelope, they can cause systems to malfunction. Areas where you have high airflow can cause malfunctions. So, detection strategies too close to supply or return air diffusers can cause unwanted alarms. So these are things that you just need to be somewhat aware of once you determine it is a non-fire event. But then also, we use our thermal imaging cameras for other things. If we're looking for, we know that airflows move from hot to cold, and you can use those and say, well, this is warmer over there, this is colder over here, and where is that device located? I can actually start seeing environmental flows. Why did that device activate? Maybe I need to look over here because that's where the pressure differential is in the building.
The bottom line is, do due diligence. There's usually a reason for the activation. Don't just get so quick into the, there's nothing here, let's go. It's one of those malfunctions. Here's a question sometimes that comes up, and some departments allow it, some don't. I'm going to put you on the seat here. To reset or not to reset? The business owner may not even be there. Does the fire department want to reset that alarm and see if it holds, or do they just want to leave it in trouble and let the building owner know that it's left that way and let them deal with it? What do you think, Chief?
That's one of those things that it is a personal preference on the fire department. Understanding what reset does, and if you're in my FDIC presentation, I bring that mousetrap, because the mousetrap kind of really indicates how a fire alarm system operates. The stimulus that caused the alarm, the mouse that takes the cheese activates the system. And so what do we do to put the system back into operational readiness? Well, we need to reset it. We need to reset that trap. However, if that stimulus is still there, the suspended particles or the remnants of the toxic gas, carbon monoxide is still there, or whatever, the heat, producing event is still there. We're going to have a difficulty getting that system to reset. But what is reset? And I think that's really what it comes down to, understanding what reset is. Reset in a fire alarm system is placing all the switches or all the devices back into their state of operational readiness. So it's not as ominous as one would think. It's like, oh, should I reset? Can I reset? My preference is the owner's there, have them reset. It's good enough to do. I mean, I don't have a problem with it. If they're not there and I don't want to leave the system in alarm, it's supposed to re-alarm if there's another device that activates, we will reset. Our preference is to have the owner do it. But sometimes, I know what reset does. If the stimulus is still there, it's going to go back into alarm because that's how a fire alarm system operates. If the stimulus is gone, everything's back into its state of operational readiness. So it really comes down to what your comfort level is and understanding your familiarization with that system.
And understand that if you're resetting it and it keeps tripping, I would do a double take, another right. check. What's going on to cause this to keep going off?
Yeah. And when anybody ever looks inside one of these devices, and I have them when I take them to my college classes, I hand them out, I pass them around, this little black chamber is designed to reflect light in a smoke detector. That's what it's looking for. And if that light gray mist gets inside there and there's no way to get it out, well, it's going to reactivate, where the smoke is still present because they burned something and now it's out into the hallway of an apartment building and such. You got to get that stimulus out of there because you can't expect the system to reset because it's only doing its very simple functions. It's very simple how these things operate, even though they look like something out of, the space agency.
How about silencing alarms? You hear that all the time. Silence the alarm left in silence mode. What does that mean? And if you leave a section, if you leave it on silent and another fire was to break out or an event somewhere else in the building, will the alarm still activate? There's a lot of confusion there.
It is supposed to. It is supposed to. I mean, you may have some older systems that may not happen because they're a physical switch that you're shutting a bell off. And that's really in the older systems. I'm going to say most of your newer systems since like the mid 1980s and after that, they are designed to what's called alarm resound. So if another device goes into alarm, it will reactivate the system. That is what it's supposed to do by design. But you may run into some of these older systems where it physically is shut off. And the sad thing is there are thousands of these old systems out there that we run into. But the idea is it's supposed to resound. And the other aspect of silencing is you really should be aware of it. It has actually had some evolutions. Originally, all fire alarm signals were bells or horns. And so silencing would silence the bells and horns. And since the 1980s into the 1990s, with the advent of ADA, we see more strobes and lights. And so there was this school of thought in the fire alarm industry that, okay, we'll silence the sounders, but we'll leave the lights flashing. And that eventually was cleared up that was not the intent. The original intent was to shut off the alarm. And so I think it was like 2002 or 2007 edition of NFPA 72, they said, no, silencing does both. Shut the lights off, shut the sounders off. Right. And so again, you're going to run into these alarm systems prior to that haven't been updated. You hit silence, I may just silence the noise makers. But the lights still stay flashing. The post systems, all of it's going to deactivate. And it really comes down, the silence button is there ultimately for us in the fire service. We had a fire at our facility earlier this year. And one of the things that one of our strategies is to replace our sounders with speakers. Because we found that people react more to when they're told what to do, not to a static noisemaker. But we noticed that the responding fire department had a really hard time communicating with that alarm system. The frequency of those sounders were really interfering with the radio communication. So the silencing of the alarm system is really there for us so we can actually do our job in a quiet environment. Yeah. Right. However, obviously, if you silence it during the day, part of your pre-incident plan, a lot of people get confused. Oh, I'm able to go back in because I got work to do. And so you need to be prepared for that, that people may start to come back in and you know, no, we're not done yet. We just did that so we could operate.
Yeah, very good.
So really point. That's what the silence button is for.
Very good point. Very good point. Is it okay to leave the scene, leaving the system in trouble? You know, a lot of times your fire companies pick up, we can't find the problem. It won't reset. So we're leaving it in trouble. Is that advisable? Will the alarm, if a fire did break out, even unrelated to the original alarm, will it re-alarm? Is it supposed to anyway?
It is supposed to, unless that trouble is associated with that one circuit. Now, the nice thing about, we talk about the analog addressable systems, some of the moderns will tell us exactly what the trouble is. But really go back to this whole, what is the trouble? It's telling me that there's a problem internally with the system, whether it's a field device, whether it's a wiring in the system, there's a problem with it. And so just a blank trouble, it really comes down to saying that system is impaired.
Yeah.
You know, and how am I going to leave that system impaired? We don't have the technical expertise, nor do we have the liability insurance to actually start to tinker with the system. Even myself, I have plenty of credentials. I can do a little bit investigation, but I'm not touching it. Really, it's the owner's responsibility. And that's kind of one of the other things that I've actually have started with the NFPA is to, I asked them to create a project to give fire departments a recommended practice for responding to automatic alarms. And one of the things that I did is I actually created a document. I sent it off to my state fire marshal's office. They actually liked it. Jack Murphy, I sent him a copy of it. Some of the folks know him from New York City area, New Jersey area. He gave me some great feedback for it and some ideas. But it really, you know, we look at the impairments because we in the fire services had always had NFPA 13E, which tells us how to operate or how we should operate or provide our educational programs for operation with buildings with sprinklers and standpipes, but we don't have one for automatic alarms. And so this is another thing that I'm trying to see if it gain traction in the NFPA to actually put together that recommended practice. And part of that is the impairment. That if you have an inspection agency, you need to let them know that the system is impaired. Yeah. The owner is ultimately responsible for seeing that impairment being taken care of. And there should be somehow, some way that once the impairment is taken care of, that we in the fire service know that system's back operational, you know, and we don't have that recommended practice right now. But ultimately, a system in trouble is a system impaired.
Yeah, for sure. You know, and if nothing else with these alarms, I love what you put in your notes too about and in your class about, you know, when you're investigating, take the time to do other things, discuss your pre-plan, discuss, hey, where's our water supply? Did the people evacuate the building like they're supposed to? What's the housekeeping like? Maybe check the Knox box or building box. Are the keys up to date? There's so many other things you can do at these calls to make them, you know, beneficial for people. It's not just a BS alarm. I used to say, I wrote an article for Fire Engineering, take 5 minutes and just spend some time with your crews talking about, okay, this was a malfunction. This was accidental. This was the result of burnt food, whatever, but take the time to go over your SOPs, SOGs, how they apply to that building and learn a little bit about the building and don't use it as a five, you know, this is all BS. You're in, you're out, you reset and go home. Take a few minutes and just look things over and become a little more educated about the building and educate your new members about the steps you took to investigate the alarm. Explain the panel, go through all of, there's so many things you can do when you point that out in your articles and in your teaching. And I think that's so important.
Yeah, and I have a another article that I've been told that's going to be published in January of 2022, and it's entitled "The Benefits of Unwanted Alarms," and I talk about a lot of those things. Yeah. You know, one big box store when I take my college students out for a field trip, you know, we know the Knox box or the fire department access box. How often do we check that? You know, tenants leave, tenants come. You know. Big box stores, their loss prevention. If somebody loses a key, every lock in the building is rekeyed. And guess who they forget to tell that they've done that? So really, you know, at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, we often want to just get in, get out. And I'm guilty of it too. You know, we got things to do.
I got that list at home, right? Yeah.
And, but do you know how often, you know, do we, you know, we'll always check the Knox box at 2 o'clock in the morning. Right. But we don't check it at three in the afternoon and say, oh, wow, did somebody change the locks? You know,
how about opening a hydrant and seeing if the yard hydrant works, flush it out, see if it works, what kind of flow you have. Yeah. There's so many things you can do. Absolutely. And educate your membership. Take the new members and explain what you're doing because they're lost. They're just watching us go through the boom, 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 we're back in service. Oh, okay. What? Let's teach them what we're doing. Let's explain to the next generation. So, Chief, we've been going for about an hour and a half, and there's so many other things I want to cover, but I definitely want to just end on this one. We talk about data collection. You and I were joking before the show and via email about data collection, doing NIFR reports or fire reports, and us at the alarm office, we do those as well. And understanding, you know, we're a malfunction versus accidental, and is water dripping on a head an accidental or a malfunction? How about a power surge due to a lightning storm setting the alarm off? Is that accidental or is that a malfunction? What's burnt food? Can drive you freaking nuts trying to understand. And there's no, and you pointed it out, there's no real education here. There's nothing to really definitively explain how we should be coding our reports, but data collection is so important. And I was wondering if you could just touch on that briefly and talk about malfunctions and accidentals and how we should be coding our NIFRs.
Well, and NIFRs is one of those things that they only give us so many selections, as you know. Oftentimes, you know, we think about lack of maintenance. Okay, that's there. But, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning during a lightning storm, is that what really caused it? Is it a malfunction? The lightning caused the system to malfunction, but it's not the system's fault. You know, water, because the roof blew off. And water now has made its way into the system. That really kind of falls into act of nature, accidental, but the system malfunctioned. But if we're only there for, you know, 5 minutes, it's not a non-fire event. We're going to reset and try to go home, or it stay on alarm. You know, we move on. We may actually code that as a malfunction. You know, water getting into the system because the toilet leaked on the third floor, you know, or somebody, you know, didn't put the shower curtain in the bathtub in the apartment complex. And now water has caused the system, yes, to malfunction, but really it was an accidental cause. And so one of my thoughts is if there's a human human involved somehow that caused it to happen, it probably leans more towards accidental. And I look at the NIFRS reports and I look at the boxes that we have options to check. And, you know, the manufacturers get this data and, you know, it's like malfunction, malfunction, malfunction. Well, what caused the malfunction? You know, there is no box malfunction due to water intrusion.
Malfunction, shower. How often do you get those?
Exactly. You know, so there is so much that, you know, really it almost like needs to expand for, you know, we have more reasons for why the sprinkler system didn't operate than we do for have the alarm system malfunction or cause the alarm. And so, yeah, how do we get good data collection? Because, you know, the U.S. Fire Administration, NFPA, the Society of Fire Chiefs, you know, we're all looking for good data,
right?
You know, because that's how we can really, you know, cater our responses and give information to the manufacturer.
And there's really no guidance out there, right? Like you make good points for the water from a storm or the lightning surge, whatever. You make very good point, but there's really nothing to guide. It's kind of just what it's up. The officer in charge is going to pick one or the other. Just like at my dispatch center, the dispatcher is going to pick one or the other. We have no guidance as to, you know, a lightning strike is this, or a power surge is this, or water from a bathtub is this. There's no guidance. It's up to the individual.
Yeah, there isn't. And you know, you have, you know, a lightning strike. Is it accidental or active nature? The active nature is not in the NIFRS report.
So, right.
Yeah. And so that was kind of one of the precursors of actually putting this in place to the NFPA. We need a new project to really start to identify whether it's a new project for a separate recommended practice. And it's not a standard. I think it's going to be a recommended practice. Because everything's a little bit different, depends on where you're at. Or do we add this chapter to the existing NFPA 13E that says, hey, okay, because sprinklers often have automatic alarms associated with them.
Yep.
We need a little bit better guidance, because data collection is really important for us to, you know, improve.
Yeah, for sure. You know, he just gave me another podcast idea. I want to have somebody on the show who understands the NIFRS. I fill them out at work every day. You know, we did 42 calls yesterday, so I did 42 NIFRS, and you just scratch your head sometimes. And I'd love to have some, if anyone knows Mr. NIFRS, if anybody knows an expert on NIFRS, I'm going to do a show on NIFRS. Someone get a hold of me and let me know who I can talk to. Cause I got,
that'd be awesome. I can't wait to hear that one.
I got a lot of questions. Chief, like I said, I could ask you a million more questions. As a matter of fact, I think we're going to do a part two. Because awesome. I have so many more questions, but we've been going about an hour and a half, which is, you know, usually pretty good for the listeners. So is there anything that we missed that you want to cover as we wrap up here? Anything you want to reinforce or reemphasize, or anything that I overlooked that I should have asked you about alarms and responding to them properly?
No, we covered a tremendous amount of information. A lot of it, if people have any questions, like I said, that one article is in the high-rise supplement of July 2020. So if anybody wants to read that, it's available for download. I'm looking forward to the article coming out in January.
Right, perfect timing. January's fire engineering. You've got that article coming out highlighting the benefits of unwanted alarms. I'm sure you'll cover some of the things we talked about today.
Absolutely.
Great. Great.
And this project initiation, I'm hoping to hear something back probably early 2022, whether it gained traction with the Standards Council Committee, and we'll see how it all goes.
Yeah, I wish you luck with that. If you need any help, let me know, because I do agree 100% with you. This is a gray area in the fire service. It's an area we get very complacent with and maybe don't do due diligence, not just on investigating, but on our reports. So you brought up some really, really good points today, and I really, really appreciate you taking the time out of your day to spend some time with me and to the listeners. Again, if people are going to FDIC, please, please, please check out the Chief's class. You'll get a lot out of it. There's a lot more to talk about that we didn't get to today. And if Chief, if anybody wants to reach out to you, they have more questions, maybe want to have you come and do your presentation for their local department, how can people get a hold of you, Chief?
Probably the easiest way to get a hold of me is my first and last name. It's Steve, S-T-E-V-E dot Heckman. Heckman, what did he say his name was? H-E-C-K-M-A-N at TrentonFire.org. So it's Steve dot Heckman at TrentonFire.org.
Excellent. Thank you so much for being on the show and raising our awareness of what we need to understand, a little bit of the history, which is always so fascinating. And, you know, I think back to folks, you know, again, BS, right? It's all BS. It's all routine. And every now and then it's not, and we have to be ready. And I think back to the great book report from Engine Company 82. I thought of this earlier when we were talking about the game wall boxes on the street corner. You know, the citizens were taught years ago, if you need anything at all, just pull that street box, and in no time at all, well-trained professionals are going to be there to help take care of your problem. Might not be a fire, might not be a medical emergency, might be a water leak, but you pull the box, well-trained professional firefighters will be here to help out. And part of being a well-trained professional firefighter is understanding what those boxes even are and how it evolved to where we're at today. That's part of being a professional. And Chief Heckman, you really helped us understand that. Thank you so much. So glad to have you here. And folks, if anyone wants to reach out to me, my contact information, I said earlier, if anyone wants to let me know who I can talk to about NIFR reports, or if anybody has any other ideas for shows and that they have, please reach out to me or comments on any of the shows. TAMerrill63@AOL.com, TAMerrill63@AOL.com. Please check out my Professional Volunteer Fire Department Facebook page, where I'm always posting news articles, information, words of wisdom, inspirational quotes, things like that. I'm on Instagram and Twitter. So check that out. And as always, thanks to Fire Engineering, my wonderful Fire Engineering family, and Chief Bobby Halton and Clarion Events for supporting my podcast and all the other great podcasts that I know you listen to. And again, I'm honored to have you listen in to my show. And I want you to know, as 2022 is right around the corner, I'll remain committed to all of you to bring you topics of relevance to our great volunteer fire service. And thank you for choosing my podcast. I truly appreciate it. And folks, one more thing I wanted to cover with you today as I wrap up, and I do it every year, and as we continue through this festive-filled month of December, something I always like to remind my listeners is that December, even though it's a very happy and fun month and joyous month where we see our loved ones and we celebrate and we get together, it's a month that has not been kind to the fire service. And you could call it a month of tragedy. And again, I'm not trying to be a downer. I'm not trying to be depressing and focus on bad things like we talked about COVID earlier. But I just think it's important as professionals to remember those we lost over the years and to learn from the fires and the tragedies that led to our brother and sister's deaths. And as the old proverb goes, as long as we speak their name, they will never die. And as professional firefighters, we owe it to those who served before and made sacrifices to remember them always. That's why it's important to have photos up at the firehouse. That's why it's important to talk about these events and remember those who passed before us, because there's lessons to be learned from each of these tragedies, and we dishonor those who suffered or we lost by not paying attention to the valuable lessons, the takeaway from the fires, and help them in our area to prevent similar occurrences from happening. So please take the time to review some of the fires and tragedies from the month of December. 1942, the Coconut Grove fire. That was at the end of November, but still at the festival time of Thanksgiving and Christmas. We talked about the Lady of Angels fire, December 1st, 1958. December 22nd, 1910, there was a Union Stock Yard fire in Chicago, killing 21 firefighters. December 22nd, 1999, Keokuk, Iowa, the second horrible fire of that month. 1999, a few weeks earlier, we had the firefighters die in Worcester, Massachusetts. We had West Webster, New York, close to my hometown, December 24th, where firefighters go into a routine car fire were ambushed, shot, and killed. My hometown, Buffalo, New York, in 1983, 2 days after Christmas, the horrific propane explosion killing 5 Buffalo firefighters. So many more. And all of these fires, all of these incidents, so many more that I didn't even mention. Pearl Harbor, for example. But they all serve as powerful reminders of the very real dangers and unpredictability of our job. And by reading about the fires, reading about the sacrifices our sisters and brothers made, we remember them, we honor them, we pay tribute to them, and we help protect our new generation of firefighters. Because as it said, those who fail to learn from history are doomed to repeat it. And that is so true in war, in politics, in life, and certainly in our fire service as well. And that's what I just would like you to remember as we go into this month. And so thank you all for joining me here. Thanks, Chief Steve Heckman. Thank you so much for being here and listening in, whether you're listening live or to a recorded episode as you work out or go about your business. Thank you. I appreciate it. And I wish you all a very happy, healthy, and joyous filled holiday season at home among your loved ones and at the firehouse with your fire service sisters and brothers. Peace and good tidings to all folks. My next show will be Tuesday, January 18th, 2022. And I look forward to you joining me then, and we'll have another great discussion. So thanks for tuning in. And remember, folks, stay safe. And true professionalism is not defined by a paycheck. And please remember, your folks are owed, your residents are owed professional service delivered by professional firefighters representing professional organizations. Take care.